You're listening to part two of episode 567 of Unwelcome Guests.
Whatever people do, the media will always either, you know, make it bigger than what it is or make it smaller. They never just say, wow, isn't that amazing for these people protesting?
Funny, because protest, it's related with breaking, destroying and demonstrating in the Batman.
Can I look? Some people can just do it sort of peacefully
Look, oye, me alegro mucho que hayáis traído el material.
So you bring all your...
Claro. In fact, we were thinking, why not? Maybe we can have like 5-10 minutes to explain this to other people.
There's a
I think that you should just put it like a...
Look, isn't there a board for...
I the same
board
one,
for workshops.
There's board for self-workshops.
Back in 5 minutes, okay?
Fun. There's a notice board to write.
I know. The only thing is that tomorrow at that time I have to be in another one.
No. Well, I see.
Another discussion, but
maybe in the evening.
What do you think? Right. One thing. What do you think drove that to happen? Like, what was the catalyst? What made it begin? I mean, I know it's really good.
Well,
first of all,
really.
No, look. One of the things is that which was the drop that made everything to start, but this, it doesn't start because something small. It's because, you know, you are living a very strong and hard situation, and many things are there. The economic situation in Spain is horrible. You know, look, for example, in Barcelona, there's around 80,000 flats totally empty, but at the same time, you are paying, like, families are paying the 50% of their wage just to pay the rent. Look, or more than the 20% of the people is unemployed in Spain. 45 of the young people below 30 in Spain is unemployed. 45%.
That's mad.
But still, they show to the rest of the people that everything is fantastic.
How did it actually start? What kind of catalyzed people to actually move?
The euro.
Yeah.
So I don't mean the economic. I mean, what got the people actually
this.
Moving to the square to begin with? What was the day?
He said just before it was for the local elections.
One of the things people are talking about is. Basically, in Spain, like Spain has only had a fascism since 1978.
Yeah.
We have to remember that in the late 70s they were doing their hands up, Sieg Heil type salutes.
I lived there then, yeah.
No? So the democracy project is up and running in only, 34 years. Maybe some argue it's not running very well, okay? This movement has been called the Democracy Real, which is like real democracy now.
That's what I've got on my Facebook. That's why I know about it, because I've got that on Facebook. Mm-hmm. But as I say, it's not in the media, not in the general media.
So look, what they said is, okay, now we have the elections, so... let's demonstrate to the people that we don't agree at all with this kind of democracy, where there's just two big parties that they make absolutely the same, and come on, they can do whatever they want, but still we're going to be fucked.
I like kids.
Okay?
You do worse than me.
Yeah, so something that started like this, with this mostly this message, okay, 2 days after the election. And now, what we do? Come on, let's continue, no? Okay, so, like this. Somebody started to go first of all in the Plaza del Sol in Madrid, which was like the center of everything. And somebody decided to sleep there, like a sort of demonstration.
Was someone or a group or something that decided to go?
I don't know who. I mean, I wasn't the first night. I wasn't there.
But it's interesting because it's not like this came out of the blue. Like North Africa, for example, the middle of the square of Plaza Catalunya, there was 3 points. One was Iceland. The other was Tahrir, like Cairo. This, like the top. if you're at the bottom of Spain, you can see Africa.
Yeah.
We're that close to Africa. It seems like a natural next step for this North African
idea. We started in Egypt, didn't it? And it's been moving throughout. And then Greece.
It's a very different country, Spain and Egypt, for example. And the situations are very different. But still, people can't continue like this.
And it is happening in Britain as well.
In Greece, they are much stronger than us. In Greece, they have the balls, you know, like... It's impressive what is happening there.
And upsetness at the same time. It's like it's the image outside. It's like they're not doing anything. But the thing is, like, you don't see they're not getting too organized. And what you have, it's like, of course.
But they're really organized.
They are. That's great.
But you're not seeing what's like, you know, we had a big demonstration in March of a union, and it was massive, really massive march and protest in London. And from that, little groups have evolved of people's assemblies, and they're constantly in London. There's a constant camp set up in London. But what do you hear about it? You don't hear exactly. You don't hear anything about it. And it is smaller than but what I'm saying is that it's having a knock-on effect throughout the world. Stuff's happened in America, but you don't hear about that either.
Yeah, but you know what the butterfly effect is? So it's like something in a very small scale, it can really change the whole system. So I really want to be optimistic, and I feel that something like this is happening.
Yeah, well,
it is happening. That's it. It's happening.
I really.
But I think that it needs to have a body and a head.
Huh?
It needs to have a body and a head, you know, because sometimes I see many bodies shaking because of the anger of the situation with no head.
It needs a bit of organization.
I see many heads with no body, you know, so it needs to get more solidified in one way.
I agree, but the point is that it goes so fast that it's quite difficult to control something like this. You don't know what's going to happen next.
Another interesting point, though, is that there's been some people are calling democracy 2.0. When you look at, especially with transition, one of the reasons why transition has grown is because of how Web 2.0 has come about. Well, the first was just you consume, you check your information. The next was you start putting in your information, you start communicating with each other. That enables ideas to spread virally, to communities start to form, etc., etc. That's been really, I think, one of the keys of how transition has just sparked and grown so big, so greatly, so quickly. One of the arguments is that, okay, the democratic system, especially in Spain's context, is maybe actually something far more interesting and better can take its place, something far more participative. Spain has had a history of very participative-type democracy in the past, so they're aware of that. Part of their talk is about those things and saying now we've got the tools to really enable this, and a part of the decision making processes are the actual the forums or discussion points. They're partly in the real world, but they're also partly in the virtual world. There's like forums for all different topics in all the different neighbourhoods, open forums, and that people, if they feel they want to go and talk there, so they can go in and look more. So it's like, have we the intelligence to actually participate in a healthier, more intelligent way? Of course we have. You know, do people want to? Well, if we don't, what? We leave it in the hands of these politicians, and what do? They leave us in the shit, and it's getting worse every day. No, we've like people are in Spain are saying, ni casa ni trabajo ni miedo. No, neither work.
No home.
No fear. Mm. You know, it's got so bad that they've lost their fear.
Come on.
Yeah. That's how all the revolutions are being triggered, you know? When you have nothing to lose, it's when you just get out of the door and you say, okay, now let's play, you know? Mm. But probably I see that all these things that we're playing around, transition movement, degrowth movement, all them will end up like a kind of solution or a structure, a possible option into what we're going to face in a very short time. I mean, it's going to be in a couple of years.
Yeah, but the people of the degrowth movement, the people of the transition movement, and many other social movements in Barcelona, they're all inside there.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I mean, we're all working together.
Yeah.
With many other people that is the first time that they make something in this.
Yeah, because always it's been like a kind of conflict.
Yeah.
You know, your theory is going this way, no, my theory is going that way.
Let's have a theory of this planet, you know, that's all it needs. It's very simple, isn't it? I know someone's talking about being settled and nomadic, but if you see the earth as your home, you're not a nomad. You can go anywhere on this planet because it's your home. You have a right to go anywhere, and that's all we need, is that theory of anywhere. That's
I would like
that instinct.
I would like you all to see.
Yeah.
Mira lo tú, porque el resto no lo tiene. ¿Cómo está organizada la plaza? Y esto es, luego creció más y evolucionó más, ¿eh? Esto es al cabo de una semana, más o menos. Yeah, but this was after 1 week. So later even evolved more. But it was really, it was like a city.
On his own, and nobody look, said, okay, this is what we need.
So it was amazing. Kitchen, healthcare, there were, you know, houses on the trees, people sleeping on the trees. It was amazing. We had a garden, we had people that always, everything was very clean.
It's part of, because some, in the culture of Spain, there's the go to the square, go to the city for Batallón. And it was big at the start. No, the big Batallón is like, let's go and have a drinking session. And it was like Batallón no es revolución. No, but drinking session is not revolution. It was like, we're here to change the system.
Yeah.
We're not here to just sit around and get
pissed.
That's
a big shift in Spanish culture, actually.
Big shift in any culture. What are you
talking
about?
No, I'm sorry. Drinking, it's something very cultural. It's really in our blood.
Drink on the street is.
It is in English culture.
Yeah, but for use on the pub. Not on the street.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So much this, well, at least you're what we're saying now, this is like in Spain.
No, you're just more open and honest about it. We have to stay behind closed doors.
Okay.
It's cold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's wet. It's
cold.
It's
a fire.
It's
cold. Yeah. Very true.
I'm sure that's
it. It's just part of mankind. Mankind drinking.
Yeah, so this is more or less...
Suppression.
But it's interesting, I think, the reaction of the British media about all of this. Because as far as I can see, the British media had virtually no coverage of what was going on.
No,
at all. But there was day-to-day coverage of what was going on in Greece.
Yes, yeah, still is.
And my question is why?
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Because it's
it
not about what is going on in Greece.
Yeah, exactly.
It's about the economy. It's about the economy.
It's about the credit, about the loans, about
Greece affects us.
About the things, but mostly German banks, you know. It's about this.
Yeah.
It's about the euro, about Europe.
Yeah.
But it's true. Why isn't the British press coming? Because the British press, I mean, they love all these stories. They love seeing revolution and people on the streets. And, you know, they've actually relished, haven't they, the kind of Arab Spring and the whole thing.
But not if it's successful, they don't like it. They don't like it.
It's not Europe.
Spain is
they only like it if it's violent. They only like it if it's violent.
But then with the...
sensational.
The Guardian had some decent coverage. Not stuff that it was maybe appearing in its printed newspaper, but some very good films covering, I don't know, one covered like a woman and her kid who are facing difficulties because of the crisis, another a fireman, some other dude. So basically just three normal people's lives. And why are they going out on June 19th? Why are they gone? And it covered their whole day, what they were doing, how their life has been affected. You know? So there was a bit.
Now, regular Unwelcome Guest listeners, I'm sure, have a more nuanced understanding of the media as a tool of other institutions with more advanced criteria to decide why some things are reported and some things are ignored. Police use of agent provocateur, for example, is openly admitted now that undeniable evidence is easily videoed and posted to YouTube, and yet hasn't come under much media attention. I mean, you might think it would be. If we believe that the police's mission is to prevent violence and make sure that laws are followed, how can we explain the police's brazen admission that they told their officers to pretend to be protesters and incite violence? Now, when police are getting paid to incite violence and law-breaking, that's a pretty clear example of what Illich is talking about, the counterproductivity of institutions. Their survival as institutions has come to dominate any stated purpose. And perhaps that's the logic which explains why commercially motivated media are so desperate for violent images that they will recycle footage of violent Greek demonstrations and try and pretend that that's what's going on in Spain. Now, such mendacious strategies are only going to work as long as people still trust the television and say, "Whoa, look at those naughty demonstrators throwing Molotov cocktails." And you've got to be pretty desperate before you put a Greek policeman and say, "This guy is from Spain." And you've got to be pretty stupid before you fail to notice that. So isn't it sad that anybody even attempted that? And it's also a short-sighted, temporary strategy. People cannot get fooled that way forever. It seems to me like communications are improving worldwide, as is the frustration with the status quo. Witness the examples that we've been hearing on the show. And now let's return to conclude Deschooling Society, written by Illich 40-odd years ago, at a very optimistic moment in history, recalling the hippies and the people coming together, possibly a similar time in history, but one that was followed by the 70s and 80s consumer booms and the ongoing ecological destruction. Must have been exasperating to watch for Illich. And later on in his life, he did develop a more apocalyptic picture of the world to come. Well, I think it unlikely that this current wave of radical democracy, of people expressing their dissatisfaction with the status quo, will be shrugged off with another consumer boom, because when people can't feed themselves and their families, then what is there left to consume? I'm looking forward to a global coming together in which people express their common humanity. As the woman remarked at the end of the last piece, a theory of humanity. Humanity in the best sense of caring for those around us, a movement of people not intent on destroying, ravaging, self-maximizing, but a team of nurturers, people growing food, people who are not distracted by confused ideas of needs or entitlements, people who are not expecting institutions to solve the world's problems, but people who are going about doing what they can already. Now, does it seem likely that one ideology could sweep the world? I'm reminded of a book I once read called One No, Many Yeses. We certainly have technologies whereby ideas can move very quickly and are not stopped by cultural or linguistic barriers, as long as there's machine translations, or better still, polyglots around. I'm also reminded of a problem of agricultural monoculture. If you grow one thing on a very large scale, then all that's needed is for one virus or one creepy crawly to arrive, which likes to eat that thing, and it can multiply and feed very quickly. You've got a much less resilient system than a polyculture, which is the natural approach. Looking on a mimetic level, a cultural level, haven't the would-be masters of the universe, with their limited imagination, haven't they just replicated the Western institutions of finance particularly, and everything else that follows from that, law, government, contract enforcement? All the Western institutions have been mass-produced and spread worldwide, and they're now resting on the ultimate threat of force. The social consensus has been eroded, and it's pretty much gone. Why do people go along with it? Not because they think it's the right thing to do, but because they're afraid for their own personal selves of what will happen if they don't go along with it. That recalling Marx's quote from a couple of episodes ago, cannot last long, and it certainly can't survive a situation in which people feel they've not got a lot to lose. So the idea, for example, that you corporate guys aren't going to feed us anyway, are you? In fact, you're destroying the planet, could spread very quickly in the modern world, because so many previously disparate societies with previously complex social, economic, cultural problems have been reduced to copies of predatory capitalism. The same problems are now manifested all around the world of a small number who claim all kind of legal, economic and other rights according to these new value systems, claim control over the rest of the population. People do tend to not want to make a fuss and avoid big conflicts, but as we've heard in the show, if they are pushed beyond a certain limit, everything changes. Now, I think Illich anticipated this turning from a Promethean expectation that institutions will manage things for us to an Epimethean discovery that the only real power is the power that we have over our own bodies to do whatever is meaningful to us. So let's hear the final chapter of Illich's 1971 book, Deschooling Society. Chapter 7, Rebirth of Epimethean Man. Our society resembles the ultimate machine which I once saw in a New York toy shop. It was a metal casket which, when you touched a switch, snapped open to reveal a mechanical hand. Chromed fingers reached out for the lid, pulled it down, and locked it from the inside. It was a box. You expected to be able to take something out of it, yet all it contained was a mechanism for closing the cover. This contraption is the opposite of Pandora's box. The original Pandora, the All-Giver, was an earth goddess in prehistoric matriarchal Greece. She let all ills escape from her amphora, Pythos, but she closed the lid before hope could escape. The history of modern man begins with the degradation of Pandora's myth and comes to an end in the self-sealing casket. It is the history of the Promethean endeavour to forge institutions in order to corral each of the rampant ills. It is the history of fading hope and rising expectations. To understand what this means, we must rediscover the distinction between hope and expectation. Hope, in its strong sense, means trusting faith in the goodness of nature, while expectation, as I will use it here, means reliance on results which are planned and controlled by man. Hope centers desire on a person from whom we await a gift. Expectation looks forward to satisfaction from a predictable process which will produce what we have the right to claim. The Promethean ethos has now eclipsed hope. Survival of the human race depends on its rediscovery as a social force. The original Pandora was sent to Earth with a jar which contained all ills. Of good things, it contained only hope. Primitive man lived in this world of hope. He relied on the munificence of nature, on the handouts of gods, and on the instincts of his tribe to enable him to subsist. Classical Greeks began to replace hope with expectations. In their version of Pandora, she released both evils and goods. They remembered her mainly for the ills she had unleashed, and most significantly, they forgot that the All-Giver was also the keeper of hope. The Greeks told the story of two brothers, Prometheus and Epimetheus. The former warned the latter to leave Pandora alone. Instead, he married her. In classical Greece, the name Epimetheus, which means hindsight, was interpreted to mean dull or dumb.